listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered community radio. And we do, on this Friday, if you're listening to us live, have a brief window of sunshine. Man, have we been getting the rain around here.
Well, in the west, it's clear, and in the east, it's cloudy.
It's cloudy. And if you're listening to Monday morning, let's hope we have some sun. We have some sun this week.
Because it's supposed to be.
Do you know what's going to happen to the garden with all this rain if we get some sun?
Boing.
Tropical paradise in the Midwest.
Yep, it will, no doubt. Yep.
Well, Mom, what have you been reading this week?
Well, I've been reading these books and the book for next week and everything in between. And the newspaper.
We have a really interesting guest today who is a friend of an old family friend, the man who introduced my mother and father to each other. Mm-hmm. He was my father's college roommate and then came to the University of Iowa for his master's degree, met my mother, and introduced her to his buddy. And the rest is history.
That's right. And
Monica's
here to prove it.
Five kids later.
Yeah. Right.
So, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Yes, I will. This is, Robert P. Watson. And he has been a professor for 22 years and is currently serving as professor and director of American Studies at Lynn University and senior fellow at the Florida Joint Center for Citizenship. As an author, he has published over 30 books, wow, two encyclopedia sets, and roughly 150 scholarly articles, essays, and book chapters on American history and politics. Several of his books are in international translation and have been nominated for awards by national academic associations.
And not only that, but as a political analyst, Dr. Watson has been on media outlets thousands of times, including CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, USA Today, NPR, BBC, Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, The Voice of America, etc., etc. And now, at the pinnacle of his career, Writers' Voices on KRUU in Fairfield. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Dr. Watson.
Well, I can retire now that I've done the Writers' Voice.
Yep, you got to the top. You got to the top, man.
So, when I'm reading your bio, Dr. Watson, by the way, would you like me to call you Robert or Dr. Watson?
Robert's fine. Yeah, more casual.
Okay. One thing that really jumped out at me is you wrote two encyclopedia sets.
Yeah, I edited and directed two encyclopedia sets, one on the American presidents and one on the American first ladies. So I recruited several dozen scholars with expertise in both topics, and we wrote essays on every president, every first lady, as well as a variety of related issues such as first lady social events they've hosted, the history of the White House, or for the presidency we profiled vice presidents. We talked about some of the greatest and worst decisions. So it was quite the undertaking. It's like having a kid. It's a couple of year long project, but it's awfully rewarding to know that those are out there and hopefully provide a good reference source for folks in libraries across the country. And let me just say, if I may, I'm a real bibliophile. I love books. I love reading. I make my living off of books. I'm always in a library. I'm old fashioned. I have Kindle, but I prefer an old book that I pull off a dusty shelf in some dark library. So I appreciate what you're doing with your show, and I really mean it when I say that I'm absolutely delighted to be able to come onto a show to talk about being an author, to talk about writing, to talk about literature. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I was really, when Dan mentioned he was working with you, I think he's helping you with some publicity or something.
Dan's been wonderful. He and a couple of friends of his just walked up to me one day and volunteered their service. I think they did because every time they see me, I look more dead than alive because I never sleep. And the bags under my eyes, I guess, were just getting to the point where they said, can we help you with some of the projects you're working on? And Dan and a couple of other of his friends have been just wonderful and doing things like this, contacting a media outlet or if I'm speaking at an area library, they'll show up and help me handle the book sales. If there's a line waiting to buy books, they'll hand out the books and help me get the change. And so they've been wonderful about being just really good volunteers. And so I enjoyed your story about about the family connections to Dan.
Oh, definitely. And there's many more where that came from. He's been part of the family all along.
Well, he's a wonderful man.
Yeah, he certainly is. Now, the two books that we're talking about today are Lincoln's Enduring Legacy, which is a group of essays, perspectives from great thinkers, great leaders, and the American Experiment, which you edited along with two colleagues, it looks like, and Affairs of State, The Untold History of Presidential Love, Sex, and Scandal from 1789 to 1900. Now, is the American presidency your primary focus?
Yeah, I teach courses on politics and history, and I'm pretty broad. I cover everything from the Congress and campaigns to military history, World War of 1812, and so forth. But I would say three quarters of my books and my writings are on the American presidents. So that's my great passion. I love that, and I've written on a couple of different presidents. Harry Truman's my favorite president, Lincoln second. So it's always fun to write on those fellows. What I've always had the view is that, and some of these people, I'm definitely not a revisionist. I think that Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, Abe Lincoln, George Washington, I think they were truly great leaders and great men. So I'm not a revisionist, but I think we sometimes make the mistake of putting them on a pedestal. And if you take, let's say, George Washington, he's really more myth than man, and more, you know, more monument than flesh and blood. It's hard to really know Washington. So what I did with this book, Affairs of State, is I thought, how can we humanize these presidents? What is there about Washington or Lincoln that we don't know? Because the greatest historians, from Doris Kearns Goodwin today to Carl Sandburg once upon a time, have devoted years to working on Lincoln or Washington. So what can I possibly do to help flesh out some new aspect of their life? And then it dawned on me, what if we look at their first girlfriend when they were a teenager? What if we look at their married lives? What if we look at their mistresses? What if we look at their relationship with their mother? What if we, and that personalizes the president, I think, in a profound way, and allows us to see them in a different lens. And what I did is I was at Mount Vernon at Washington's home, and I asked one of the archivists once, I said, can you get me some old love letters when Washington was a teenager? And they looked at me and said, no one's ever asked for that. And then that's when the eureka moment occurred, and I said, precisely.
Wow.
So what I found out, for example, in writing about sort of scandals and love lives, is that when Washington was a teenager, like so many folks, he had acne, he was insecure, and it appears that he got dumped by several girls. So I thought, how fun is that? You know, there's a side of George Washington you don't hear about very often. And, you know, I don't think I've ever looked at a textbook that made me laugh or cry, because we take all the good stuff out of the textbooks. So this was an effort. The Lincoln book was an effort to try to celebrate 200 years after his birth, his enduring legacy, and try to get a sense of why Lincoln remains perhaps the most iconic figure in American history and the standard by which all presidents are measured. And the Affairs of State book was an attempt to not be a revisionist or not, you know, out a president for what they did or didn't do, but simply a way of taking a look at them when they're all too human. And it's a fun, I think, you know, it was a fun, delicious undertaking, and I hope readers will feel the same way.
And like the introductory page says, is titled, "They Don't Teach the Stuff in School."
No, they don't.
No, that's for sure.
I never had it in a doctoral class or an undergraduate class or in third grade.
Well,
so as I was reading all this, a lot of it was brand new to me.
Well, there are a couple of really interesting things that came out of this book for me. And one is, particularly with Washington, the huge influence that women had on the man that he became. You know, we look at Washington as a self-made man, but you're really putting forth the theory that he was a woman-made man.
Absolutely. You know, I've always said this idea of a self-made man, many of the self-made men are wife-made men or mother-made men, and the fingerprints of women are all over American history. We just have chose to pick up the carpet and dust it under the rug. But with Washington, you see that in several instances. Number one, he was a rather middle-class, ambitious, still single, unsuccessful military officer when he meets Martha Dandridge Custis, possibly the wealthiest widow in all of Virginia, who was also older than him. And Washington courted her in lightning speed. And in marrying Martha, George goes from a frustrated middle-class, you know, moderately successful military officer to one of the most wealthy and powerful men in all of Virginia. So even though I think Washington was as great as history books say, and I'm a big, big fan, so I'm not a revisionist, I do believe that if George had not met Martha, history would never have remembered his name. By the same token, when he's a teenager, now his father had made a little bit of money, but George had the misfortune of being the firstborn to the second wife, and George's father, Augustine, could not stand his second wife. So when he died, when George was a boy, he leaves everything to the sons from the first marriage. So they're educated and traveled. George is milking cows and surveying and is uneducated and untraveled. But a neighbor, Sally Fairfax, is considered to be one of the most elegant, intelligent, and beautiful women in all of Tidewater, Virginia. And when George meets her, she's 2 years older than him. She's married to, you know, Lord Fairfax. So in other words, she's so far out of his league. But what George is he's absolutely head over heels with her. And Sally, in a sort of a flirtatious way, she recognizes the possibilities that Washington has, the raw talent. And it's Sally that teaches him the art of social discourse. She teaches him how to dance and curtsy. She introduces him to the powerful people in society that he would need to know if he's going to be the George Washington that history remembers. Sally pretty much takes him under her wing, sits him at her feet during her famous social events, and tutors him, if you will. So these two and other women really, I think, I don't think we can overstate the influence and role that they've had on Washington, yet I think many scholars historically have been reluctant to say that because it somehow, I believe, minimizes Washington. Mm-hmm. When I think it's not mutually exclusive. Washington can be the great man who, you know, unlike anyone else, is able to win the Revolutionary War with a ragtag band of, you know, poorly educated farmers and ill-equipped blacksmiths. But by the same token, had it not been for Martha or Sally, George would have been surveying into his 30s.
So. Of course, maybe the fact that he could lead those men was because he was one of those men.
I absolutely agree with you. I think you're onto something. I've written, I don't remember if it's in this book, but I've written elsewhere multiple times that the framers, the founding fathers, were great men, no doubt about it. You know, the Jeffersons, Adams, Madison, these were learned men. But the one thing that George had that all the rest of them didn't, they all had fast wine collections, knew other languages, were writers and philosophers and played the viola or violin. The one thing George had that none of the rest had, he had calluses on his hands. He had slept under the stars. Mm-hmm. He had fought Indians with his bare hands. He knew how to make a fire out in the wilderness. He could navigate by the stars. He, you know, so George had actually been out doing that. So I agree with you completely that he understood his men. He understood the lay of the land. He understood the way Indians fought, which he used then to fight against the British. And that allowed him to, so he reaches back into, I think, his youth for leadership lessons during his command.
Yeah, he probably didn't even realize he was doing that, but that was part of his persona. And
I think you're right.
You know,
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Now, who was the third influential woman in Washington's life?
There was a woman, a rather saucy woman, as how she was described by one contemporary named Eliza Willing Powell. Her husband was the mayor of Philadelphia, and he was sort of, I apologize, but I've never been a Rudy Giuliani fan, so I hate to use the analogy, but you know when Giuliani was America's mayor, and everyone loved Giuliani, and he was seen as sort of the great patriot in the country, and his stoic leadership after 9/11. Well, Mayor Powell was the same way. During the Revolutionary period and during the early days of the country, he was America's mayor. So, and Eliza was his wife. She was wealthy, well-educated, full of herself, flirtatious, sort of a Dolly Madison character. And George, of course, the capital was moved from New York City to Philadelphia while they're building Washington, D.C. So George dines regularly for years with the Powells. And at one point, I believe it was a yellow fever. There was an epidemic that ran through Philadelphia, and everyone was encouraged to flee. of course, Mayor Powell says I refuse to because he's the country's mayor. His wife says I refuse to abandon my post. I'm standing beside him. So George stays with them. And unfortunately, Mayor Powell dies. So during her years as a widow, she and Washington remain remarkably close. What you find is that many people that write to Washington, not the young Washington, now the great Washington, even his own adopted grandchildren called him the general. Prominent members of Congress would defer to him as, oh, the great general. But Eliza Powell writes these saucy and sometimes critical letters. She reprimands him. She speaks freely. She tells him what to do. She comments on his clothing. She becomes kind of a counselor as well as supporter. And he values her advice, I believe, more than most anyone. And it's a real cute story where when Washington leaves Philadelphia, he has one of those large old-fashioned, I think they call them secretary desks, that roll in and roll out and have the 100 little compartments in it. He gives her his desk, which was one of his prized possessions. Well, when he gets back home at Mount Vernon, she sends him this magnificent letter where she's going through the little drawers and she finds a bunch of love letters.
Oh.
Drawers with a little red ribbon wrapped around them. So she writes to George, and other people would be mortified at such a disclosure or too embarrassed to say it to Washington. She teases him, saying, I found these letters, of course I wouldn't read them, but she goes on to basically say that she read them all. She teases him, and then she wonders if he'll come pick them up, and Washington writes back in a very uncharacteristic tone, kind of sheepishly saying, oh, they're really not love letters, I'm not sure what you're talking about, kind of a tone. So she enjoys playing with him, and that she is kind of has an upper hand on it, and he goes back to Philadelphia to visit her without Martha going back with him, and so she is just a really interesting figure. And I think, to Washington's credit, these three women are all really impressive women. So he surrounded himself with opinionated, capable, resourceful, very interesting women, and their role in his life is, I believe, unmistakable.
Well, how did Martha feel about his close relationship with these other two women?
Good. Yeah, we don't know. Here's what we do know. When George dies in mid-December of 1799, Martha lives until May of 1802. When Washington dies, there are, you know, limitless letters. When Martha dies, there's only two or three of their letters that survive, and only 150-some of her letters that survive. So what historians believe, we have no proof one way or the other, but what we believe is she burned all those letters after his death as a way of trying to recapture her privacy. So unfortunately, much of that is lost. Mm-hmm. There is enough, though, that I feel we can speculate. For example, we know that George and Martha would frequently go for carriage rides or picnics or dinners with Sally Fairfax and her husband, Lord Fairfax. So Martha was in their company. Martha liked them. Also, we know that Martha and George dined all the time with Mayor Powell and his saucy wife, Eliza. So Martha was around them quite a bit. I think George was head over heels smitten with Sally Fairfax. I absolutely believe that. The letters, I think, would suggest as much. So I wonder if Martha didn't pick up on some of that. If she did, we don't know if she said anything. We do know, however, that they continued to, you know, dine together and pal around together. But I don't know that there's any evidence that George actually was unfaithful. I think it was one of those long-time flirtations that he never acted on. We don't know one way or the other, but that's what I feel is pretty safe. What I do know, though, is that the Fairfaxes, Sally and her husband, her husband was a loyalist. So when the war is ready to break out, they leave and go back to Britain, intending on coming back as soon as the British have done away with the pesky colonials. Of course, they never come back. So they trust George so much that Lord Fairfax and Sally asked George to auction off their mansion, Belvoir. Now, if Lord Fairfax felt that George was sleeping with his wife, he wouldn't have entrusted him like that. So I think it was sort of that innocent flirtation. George auctions off the home and all the possessions inside and sends the money to the Fairfaxes because he's so trustworthy and they're so close. But George keeps for himself only one item from the auction: Sally's silk bedroom pillow, which he carries around with him. And when I found that out, I thought, gosh, I never read about that at Valley Forge. No. And I think that you can read into that. And late in his life, he writes some really touching. George's letters are pretty dull to read, quite frankly. He's kind of matter of fact. But he writes some flowery, very touching letters to Eliza Powell, and what appears to be about the longest letter he ever wrote was written to Sally. It was written again. He hasn't seen her since before the Revolution. It's the year 1798, wow. 1 year after his presidency ends, 1 year before his death. So he's an older man. He's been married for forever to Martha, and he hasn't seen Sally in decades. He writes her this letter, and it's the longest one I read of his. It says that he can't ride by Belvoir without, you know, shedding a tear and reflecting on her, and he thinks about his time in her company, and he says, those were the happiest moments of my life. And he longs to see her again and hopes that she'll come back. She doesn't. So I think that deep sentimental attachment that they had is something that historians, that we all have to pay attention to.
Wow.
It's a great story. What might have been kind of a story, and that's not to minimize Martha. And I believe, and I've said this in this book, and I said it in I think two other books, that there's more to Martha than meets the eye. The problem is, every time we picture Martha Washington, we picture in a little white bonnet.
Yep.
And
yep.
Whereas there's a portrait or two of her when she was young, where she's lean, she looks confident, her head's up, she's wearing a very fashionable dress. Now, if we showed that picture of Martha, the country would have a different perception of her. But for whatever the reason, textbooks always show the sort of frumpy grandmotherly Martha who doesn't want to have her picture, her portrait painted, sitting there with her bonnet on. And there's a couple of quotes from her that show her to be very caring, very warm, very capable. But there's one quote from her that always pops up whenever you research Martha. It's a quote that she did. It's kind of cute. She says, let me make sure I get this right. She says, quote unquote, I'm an old-fashioned Virginia housekeeper, cheerful as a cricket, busy as a bee, and steady as a clock, end quote. Now, that's cute, but it kind of portrays her, you know, as just baking cookies and worrying about her grandkids, which she did, but there was so much more to Martha. So Martha was a vastly more intriguing and more capable person than this kind of simplistic, monolithic Mrs. Santa Claus image that she's remembered by most historians. And I think part of that has to do with to show her as this capable, impressive woman, that without her money, George would have been no one. I think that people believe that that will somehow diminish the great Washington, mm-hmm. the father of our country,
yeah.
but I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, it really brings home, the like you say, how much women have been overlooked in history. I guess that's
absolutely
why it's called his story and not her story. And there's a, I'm trying to remember the name of the writer who wrote some kind of popular history books, What You Didn't Learn in High School.
Oh, yeah, there's a whole series of those,
right.
What Your Teachers Didn't Teach You in School.
Right.
They're very good. They're fun.
Yeah. And one of the stories there is talking about looking at historical markers. And, for example, there's a historical marker about the first settler in Ohio. Well, that he built this cabin single-handedly. And what they don't tell you is that his wife was there, too, and we really don't think she was sitting around crocheting while he was building the cabin.
Yeah, she wasn't, you know, at the club getting a manicure.
Right, right.
So, but we've ignored that. If you think about how unbelievably challenging it would have been for those first pioneers who went west, think about a mother and a wife trying to prepare a meal, sewing clothing, or raising children without a hospital, without relatives, without a microwave oven, in the middle of the winter in on the plains. That is unthinkable for most of us alive today. Yet women's voices have been silenced on that whole aspect. I think, fortunately, it's changing as more female PhDs are minted every year and are going into history, and as great writers like Doris Kearns Goodwin bring unique perspectives to light. It's fortunately changing, but historically, in fact, I came across this with President James Monroe, our fifth president. Monroe's wife, Elizabeth, was a very impressive woman. She was sort of an early Jackie Kennedy, an attractive Francophile. Very impressive woman, smart, bold, and yet Monroe never even mentions her in volumes of writing. So the knee-jerk reaction is to think they had a rotten marriage. But there was sort of a convention back then, and it was Teddy Roosevelt's wife, Edith Roosevelt, who once said that a true lady, Edith Cairo Roosevelt, a true lady's name should appear in print only three times, her birth announcement, her wedding announcement, and her obit.
Yeah.
So Monroe doesn't mention his wife, and I suspect because it was seen as somehow in a sexist earlier day and age as unbecoming of a lady, and it's a shame because we are missing out. There's so much we don't know about Mrs. Monroe, but the little bit we do know is she was a very impressive person. Unfortunately, those aspects of history, a lot of that is gone, is just unretrievable, but there's other areas where I think we can make progress. And I really enjoyed, with this book, there are the John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and Warren Harding and Bill Clinton, you know, this sort of the sexual conquest guys looking for a mistress. But there are some of the other women in history were very impressive women, and there was a cerebral, not just a physical, but a cerebral element to the relationship where they were counselors, advisors, and sounding boards on presidential decisions. And I thought that was just a lot of fun to read up some of that information.
Mm-hmm. And really something that's been ignored to a large extent. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Dr. Robert Watson, the author of, among many books, Affairs of State, The Untold History of Presidential Love, Sex, and Scandal from 1789 to 1900, and Lincoln's Enduring Legacy. So, Robert, one of the other things that came out that really struck me in reading Affairs of State is that we maybe have a tendency to think that sort of the gossip and the criticism and the scandal surrounding politicians today is a new thing. And it's really never really been much different, has it?
You're absolutely right. Whenever there's I do a lot of media commentary, and whenever there's a scandal, my first line is I always say, you know, we've been there, done that. That whatever Elliot Spitzer did or Arnold Schwarzenegger did or Bill Clinton did, there's many, many examples in history of that. You go back to our third president, Thomas Jefferson. His second year in the White House, 1802, his second year is when the story broke about Sally Hemings, the slave mistress. And it's a very salacious story. The journalist, and I put that in quotes, he was more of a, today he'd be writing for a tabloid rag or something. The journalist from Scotland, his name was James Callender. He's the one who broke the story. What it was Callender used to be kind of a hatchet man for Jefferson, and he would write dirt on Jefferson's enemies. But under the Alien and Sedition Acts at the end of John Adams' presidency, he's basically arrested for writing crap about John Adams. So he's put in jail, and he writes to Jefferson asking Jefferson for money, and would he please help get him out of prison. Jefferson realizes by this time James Callender's become a bit of a political liability and a hot potato. So Jefferson doesn't want anything to do with him and kind of cuts him loose. So when Callender gets free, he goes to work for Jefferson's enemy, Alexander Hamilton, and he knows all Jefferson's secrets. So he's the one who writes the story, I think it was in the Richmond Recorder, the paper, about Jefferson having this mistress and all these biracial kids running around the plantation. They called them derogatorily Yellow Toms. But there's been a long history of this kind of thing. When Grover Cleveland was running for president, a story broke that he had been sleeping with a woman named Maria Halpin, who was, if she wasn't a prostitute, she was pretty close to it. And they had probably had an illegitimate kid, a son. And that became a big scandal. And Cleveland's critics and the Republicans even had a little chant that they would do at their convention and at other public events. They would yell, in regards to Cleveland's kid looking for his biological father, they would yell, "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" But then when Cleveland won, the Democrats followed that rhyme by saying, "Ma, Ma, where's my pa? Going to the White House, ha, ha, ha." So, you know, today you could almost see, you know, the Romney and Obama supporters, you know, yelling that or Tea Party folks criticizing Obama or whatever. So, yeah, we've got had a long history of this kind of a thing. And to make the story even a bit funner was Cleveland, his opponent was James G. Blaine. And James G. Blaine was very critical of Cleveland's womanizing, which it was very moderate by any standard, not to say that I'm excusing it, but and they even push these stories that if Cleveland's elected, women of Washington, the men of Washington will have to lock their daughters and wives away. Cleveland will be prowling the streets at night. I mean, pretty over the top stuff. Well, James G. Blaine is milking that story for all it's worth, but then it comes out that he's probably had more mistresses than Cleveland, and his wife gave birth less than 9 months after they married. So it blows back in James G. Blaine's face. So you know, whatever we have today with celebrities and politicians is certainly not new.
Absolutely not. Now, you mentioned that Truman was your favorite president. Would you
absolutely
care
yeah.
to explain why?
Well, I find Truman to be irresistible in many ways. He was the last president to lack a college degree. He failed 3 times in life business-wise, and yet he rises up to become this extraordinary leader. You know, on April 12th of 45, when Franklin Roosevelt died, you know, the papers and the public basically said, Harry who? And Truman comes in at this critical hour and is a great leader. And what I think is so compelling to me about Truman is Truman was raised in a relatively racist, anti-Semitic, sexist household, and he marries into an even more bigoted family in Bess's family, the Wallaces. Yet Harry Truman, second I think only to Abraham Lincoln, becomes the greatest human rights, civil rights leader in the history of the White House. He's the president that pushes for a civil rights bill. When Southern Democrats and the Republicans defeat it, he's not deterred. He passes Executive Order 9981, which integrates the armed forces. Truman fights for Jewish immigration after the Holocaust. He pushes for women's issues. He pushes for universal health care. He pushes for public housing. So he's this amazing human rights champion, and I think it's a compelling story because he grows up just the opposite. So it shows you that you can teach an old dog new tricks, and I find that to be irresistible when someone's able to overcome their upbringing and really grow as a person and socially and intellectually and in a compassionate way. And that was Harry Truman. And there are just so many wonderful quotes that I've dug up over the years when I visit the Truman Library about Truman being faced with a tough decision, and ultimately he would cut through the polls, cut through the arguments for and against, and say, what's the most moral thing we can do? How can we do right? How can we do good? How can we help people? And I think he was kind of Boy Scouty in that way, and I think that a lot of his great decisions were quite simply Truman seeking to do what he felt was the best and right thing to do. And in this day and age of, you know, poll-driven politicians and, you know, plastic televangelist-like political leaders, you know, and sound bites, Truman is refreshingly honest, and I really like that. He made mistakes, no doubt, but there's one great line where Truman is Truman's pushing civil rights and Jewish immigration in 48. Of course, that's an election year, and he's facing a tough run against Mr. Dewey, and most polls and people think Dewey's going to win. So his advisors say to Truman, they said, you know, if you push, in order for you to win, you're going to have to pretty much sweep the South. You're going to have to take Dixie, take the heartland. And if you're pushing women's issues, Jewish immigration, and civil rights, that's not going to happen. And Truman says to them, he says, quote, unquote, and they show him the polls that show that he's not going to win. Truman says, how far would Moses have gone in Egypt if he had a pollster? How far would Jesus have gone if he had a pollster? And then he basically tells them, I'm going to do what's right, and that's the end of the story. So, you know, I find him to be just refreshingly real and honest. He made mistakes, but I think there's so many wonderful lessons to be gleaned from someone like a Harry Truman.
Well, what I always remember him as is a man of the people.
Yep. Oh, no doubt.
I had
the great honor of interviewing over the last 12 years all the living advisors that worked for Harry Truman, including his secretary, and a couple of them have since deceased. But one of the things they all told me was they said when you went to work for him, two things. They said you felt like calling him Harry. He was so real. But the second thing they all said was when you went to work with him, he would sit down new staffers, speech writers, aides, and he'd give them the same talk. He'd say, you know, gentlemen, as long as you work for me, he goes, know this, the rich people, they have their lawyers, the big businesses have their special interests, they have their lobbyists, they have their, but the regular people, all they have is you and me. So don't you forever, ever forget that as long as you work for me. And all these years later, these aides would tell me that, and they'd get a tear in their eye when they said it, and I thought, wow, boy, I'd love to go to work for someone that's the first thing they tell me when I go to work for them. So
well, I got a tear in my eye when you told that story. It's amazing. Why do you think Truman has been overlooked?
Well, you know, Truman follows Franklin Roosevelt, who is the modern equivalent of a Lincoln, and he's the modern yardstick by which all presidents are measured. FDR was charismatic. You know, that wonderful patrician voice, the fireside chats, leads us through the war, through the Great Depression. He is Shakespearean in that he's a wordsmith. He's dashing and handsome. Truman's followed by Eisenhower, who's the supreme Allied commander and America's great hero. So he's sandwiched in between two absolutely compelling folks. Also, I think Truman was, you know, he was unpopular during his presidency. The very first public opinion poll on a president was conducted by the Gallup organization back in 1933. And from 1933 until today, the president who had the all-time lowest approval, now W had the highest disapproval, even lower than Nixon on Watergate, lower than Clinton after Lewinsky, lower than W after Katrina, the lowest approval in history was Truman. So Truman, when he left office, was seen as, there was an old saying, they would say, to err is Truman. So it's taken a long time for the country to kind of see the wisdom in all that Truman did. And if you look back at some of the huge fights that he had, Truman, for example, vetoed a lot of bills, and he was overridden on a lot of his vetoes. So one of the measures that we use as scholars to try to assess presidential greatness is they should be able to not even have to veto a bill because they have their way with Congress, or if they do veto a bill, it certainly isn't overridden. Well, Truman gets overridden all the time. But if you go back and you look at the bills that he vetoed and he was overridden on, it was these horrible Joe McCarthy, you know, Red Scare witch hunt. It was some really misguided, horrific things. So even if you look at a measure like Truman being overridden on his vetoes, you go back and what you realize in a revisionist way is that Truman was standing up for civil liberties in the American way against all these Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, these Warren, McCarran, all these, you know, witch hunt type of folks. So I think it's taken quite a while for him to get his proper due, and, you know, he was not dashing. Unlike Grant or Jackson or Washington or Eisenhower, or heck, if you even go back to, you know, William Henry Harrison or Zachary Taylor or Garfield, we had all these great generals who went on to be president. Truman was a captain, artillery battery D of the Missouri National Guard. So poor Harry, even there, he doesn't have that sort of dashing. So I think it's taken David McCullough's wonderful book, and it's taken a lot of years for people to begin to see the greatness of Harry Truman.
I think his most famous quote wasn't it, "The buck stops here."
Absolutely, and what a great quote he took. He had that on the plate that he kept on his desk, and that's typical of Truman. I accept responsibility for everything. Uh-huh. It's my call, and if it goes wrong, I'll take the heat.
Wow. Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Robert Watson, author of Affairs of State and Lincoln's Enduring Legacy. And before the hour gets away from us, Robert, why don't you read a selection from Lincoln's Enduring Legacy, and also tell us a little bit about how this book came to be.
Okay. Well, Lincoln was born in 1809, so 2009, we not long ago passed the bicentennial of his birth. And scholars marked that occasion by hosting conferences all around the country. There were traveling Lincoln exhibits, and there was a whole flurry of literature and scholarship that came out on Lincoln. And I think that's good. Every once in a while, I believe we need to update what we know about the presidents and look anew at them. And even as iconic as Lincoln is, I think that was necessary. So I participated in some of these events in 2009, and in the years after that, I worked with a colleague, William Peterson, who runs the International Lincoln Center down at LSU, and Frank Williams, who until recently was the Supreme Court Chief Justice in Rhode Island, and he is one of the largest private collectors of Lincoln memorabilia. So they both, and they're both officers in all the Lincoln associations. So I proposed to them that we convene a group of leading scholars, have a get together, and we offer some reassessment of Lincoln's legacy. So that's where this project grew out of. And I have a little excerpt here. I'll just read maybe four paragraphs. It's at the end of the first chapter where I'm kind of talking about the search for Lincoln as we continue to be intrigued by this great man. And I said, Lincoln was the most unlikely of leaders. He was uneducated, suffered a hardscrabble upbringing, and hailed from the remote frontier. Yet Lincoln possessed an extraordinary set of characteristics for leadership. He was a skilled politician. enjoyed a near photographic memory and healthy intellectual curiosity, and was an inspiring writer and rhetorician. His was a compelling, if not Shakespearean, life of tragedy. He suffered the loss of numerous loved ones, including his mother, older sister, and two sons, was thought of as socially awkward and physically repulsive, and struggled with melancholy, or by today's standards, depression, throughout his life. But on a personal side, Lincoln was admired for his warm storytelling and jokes, as well as for his formidable intellect, and he touched those around him through his extraordinary empathy and humility. Lincoln was naturally prudent and cautious, but took bigger political risks than nearly any other president. A student of the Constitution, Lincoln nonetheless knew he had to view it creatively and was willing to push the limits of constitutional interpretation and civil liberties. Faced with the question of allowing the Union to disappear or spilling blood to save it, this apostle of peace understood that war was necessary for free government to endure. Just as the country was being torn apart from contradictions during Lincoln's life, so was Lincoln himself a complex man full of contradictions. Few knew him well, but many loved him. Strangers, for instance, were greeted by Lincoln's warmth and thoughtfulness, but even colleagues and family members struggled to understand him. Ultimately, the least prepared president in American history would emerge, arguably, as its greatest. And what I go on to say after that is I ponder, much like Christians do with the saying, "What would Jesus do?" that I think for generations, leaders have posed that question, "What would Lincoln do if Lincoln was alive today?" So I kind of bring it to a quick paragraph ending here. Lincoln's reputation over the years has ebbed and flowed, and extraordinary changes have come to both the political party he helped found and the nation he helped forge. He continues to be evoked by everyone from Marxists to civil rights leaders, by both major political parties in the United States and nearly every political leader since his time. Lincoln himself, as well as defining moments of his life, his birth in a log cabin, his image as a rail splitter, the debates with Stephen A. Douglas, the Cooper Union address, the Emancipation Proclamation, and his oration at Gettysburg, and even his assassination by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theater, are iconic images of Americana. At the occasion of his bicentennial, Lincoln remains as an inspiring figure, and many still ask, what would Lincoln do? And his lofty status in America, in American and world history, is secure, but requires continued study. As Secretary of War Edwin Staunton so aptly declared on Lincoln's deathbed, now he belongs to the ages. Indeed.
You know, when we were talking about the president's wives, and of course, his wife was also came from money, and people couldn't understand why she married him.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the, you know, politics makes for strange bedfellows.
Yeah.
That's one of those marriages where opposites attract. You know, Mary Todd was a very wealthy, somewhat spoiled, high-maintenance debutante from an old money family, and Lincoln's dirt poor, you know,
yeah,
a farmer.
Right.
And even the Todd family could not stand Lincoln, and they all of them opposed her marriage to Abe, and numerous friends tried to talk her out of it. Lincoln had a funny line. The Todds, Mary's family, spelled their last name T-O-D-D. And Lincoln would always say, while one D is good enough for God, the Todds require two. He thought they were a bit snotty. And the marriage was a strained marriage at best. But behind all the strains and stress and their many highly public fights that they had, they both shared something that they lost a mother when they were young. And Lincoln, unlike almost any man of the time, he valued the fact that Mary Todd was opinionated and loved politics. Very few other men at the time would have done that. So they made a political partnership, and it was a strong political partnership, if a weak, emotional marriage.
Well, there's been a great deal written about her, that's for sure.
Yes.
I mean, I have a couple books about her.
Right. And I'm just looking in, because you talk about them in the Affairs of State book. Their wedding was sort of unusual.
Yeah, to say the least. Lincoln always called it the fatal first because it occurred on the January 1st. They were engaged, and he got cold feet and broke up with her, the day of the wedding, basically. And friends were so concerned, they thought he was suicidal after breaking up with her, and he went into a deep funk, a deep depression. So they were I guess the way to say it in a short way is they were the kind of couple that couldn't live with one another, but couldn't live without one another. And eventually they get back together after quite some time. And it's a rough marriage. And it certainly has its moments. They have four sons, and three of the four sons die young. Mm-hmm. The second son, Eddie, dies right before his fourth birthday. The third son, William Wallace, dies in the middle of the Civil War in February of 1862. So they really never get beyond that. And their last son, Thomas, they nicknamed him Tad, who had a learning issue and disability, he dies as a young man right after Lincoln is killed. So Mary Todd buries three of her four sons, buries her husband, buries most of her relatives who died in the Civil War. The South never forgives her for marrying Lincoln. The North never trusts her. So Mary Todd lived this unbelievably tragic life, and even though she's widely criticized today and painted as kind of a nut, she was put into what would today we would call an insane asylum at Batavia, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
But she was done so by her sole remaining son, Robert. But it appeared she was a few cards shy of a full deck, but it appears that Robert did that because she was spending his inheritance and embarrassing him politically with some of her comments and extravagant lifestyles. So Mary Todd lived a really tough life, and who among us wouldn't be, you know, just torn apart by the kind of tragedy that she suffered? So I've always found her a more compelling figure than a lot of her critics.
Well, you know, he married, her son married Senator Harlan's daughter. And
right.
And there that was he was from Mount Pleasant, which is where I'm from, and there's
okay.
there's a house over there, the Harlan Lincoln House, and yeah, they lived there for a while.
Now, what was your take on the recent movie Lincoln?
I thought it was fantastic. I think Tony Kushner's script, Daniel Day-Lewis's depiction, Lincoln's direction, or Spielberg's direction, I thought it was outstanding. I called and emailed probably a dozen scholars of the American presidency after the movie. We here at Lynn University in Florida, we hosted the third and final presidential debate. So I organized as part of our debate festivities an advanced screening of the Lincoln film. So once it came out commercially, I contacted these scholars and asked them to weigh in on it, and all of them said, yeah, it's 95% accurate. I had the wonderful good fortune a couple of weeks ago of going to the Ford Presidential Museum with some politicians and scholars and celebrating what would have been Betty Ford's 95th birthday and Jerry Ford's 100th, which is this summer. And Richard Norton Smith and some of the leading presidential historians in the country were there. And over drinks, I asked them all, I said, everybody, I want to hear you weigh in on the movie. We went around the table and everyone said the same thing. They thought it was spot on accurate. So these couple of historians that are getting ink because they pick out one or two inconsistencies or inaccuracies, I forgive those. Overall, it's a remarkably historical film, and I like the depiction of Lincoln. I thought it was brilliantly done.
Now, speaking of Betty Ford, she took a lot of flack for doing something that was really a very good thing, didn't she?
On more than one occasion. I've always been a big Betty Ford and Jerry Ford fan. I think because they were honorable folks, and they were both as honest as the day is long. Yeah, Betty Ford, you know, of course, she goes public with her bout with breast cancer in 74, right after he becomes president. And in the Ford Library and Museum, there's some very interesting archival materials, and I think this is why the Ford folks invited me up to celebrate this event and speak at it. I've always been a big defender of Betty Ford's. What you find is she went public with breast cancer, and it's probably the first time the word breast was spoken in primetime television. And in the weeks after her comment, hundreds of letters poured in from Republicans, Southern preachers, condemning her, just demanding an apology, saying she's never invited into their church or the party should throw her out. Just horrible letters. But what you find over the next couple of years, thousands of letters come in from women who say, because of you, I had the courage to get a screening, and I found it early, and I'm alive today because of you. Or women that said, I needed to have the surgery, and I didn't want to do it because I thought my husband wouldn't find me attractive, but you did it, and I am, you know, thanks to you. Or you had thousands of letters from kids that said, our mother's alive because of you, or my wife is alive because of you. So Betty Ford probably did more for breast cancer awareness than anyone. And then she did the same thing with the Ford Clinic and her addiction issue. Mm. She had fallen off of a ladder and hurt her neck, and back in those days, they told you, you know, if you hurt, take this pill, and whenever it hurts, take the pill. So yeah. She took too many, and as a congressional and later VP and presidential wife, she's drinking at parties, and she developed an addiction, but God bless her, she went public, and I think brought that out of the closet, and more families that have had to deal with such a thing probably were able to do so because of Betty Ford. And even that 60 Minutes interview she had, I think it was Morley Safer who ambushed her, and I believe that a president should be asked almost any kind of question, but I do believe certain things are off limits for family members. She was ambushed with these questions about basically, you know, the 70s, these kids are having sex and using drugs. What would you do if your daughter Susan came home pregnant or was using drugs? And I just don't think that was appropriate to ask her. But you ask Betty Ford a question, she's going to give you an honest answer. And she said basically, you know, we raised our kids, hopefully they're not doing that, but kids are doing this thing these days, and why we would stand beside her and love her. Now, that's the right answer for you and I today, but again, Southern preachers, her own political party just railed against her, and I've always given Jerry Ford credit for refusing to do this when his own party said that they wanted demanded an apology on her behalf, and can't you silence her? And Jerry Ford loved Betty, as opinionated as she was, and she had this great line where Betty Ford would say, "Ladylike does not require being silent." I've always admired what she did, even if I disagree with some of the Ford family policies. I think they were great people.
Robert, we've only got a few minutes left. Could you read us just a short bit from Affairs of State?
Ooh, okay, let me. Here we go. So this is the end. I was talking about George Washington having affairs and historians trying to put it in the closet. So until the highly public foibles of recent political leaders were made public, generations turned a blind eye to the possibility that Washington and other presidents were capable of loving women other than their wives or engaging in inappropriate sexual behavior. Those who write our history have often been unwilling to even imagine immoral behavior among our leaders. But the reality has been quite different. Our political heroes and leaders have been human, and some of them all too human. Yet few scholars are themselves trained in matters of the heart or hearth. So it is perhaps obvious that the love interests and sexual shenanigans of presidents have been overlooked by the historical record. The fact of the matter is that there is a long history of sexual impropriety, marital peccadilloes, and lapses in judgment and integrity associated with leaders, both in the United States and around the world. At the same time, there are happy and healthy marriages, as well as genuinely sappy love affairs that flourished in the White House. Both types of stories fill the pages of this book. In fact, so widespread are our political political scandals of the past, that stories of sex and lust could fill many volumes, which is why my book only goes to the year 1900. The next one will come out soon. To be sure, political spouses and mistresses, through their loving marriages or purely sexual relationships, have played a role in shaping the events and leaders that, in turn, made history. And then I go on and I close by saying, for whatever reason, history has rarely recorded these affairs of state.
So is it true you're working on the next volume in this?
Yeah, it's not my next book project, but it is coming out. I'll probably write a companion to this to take us from 1901 up until today, probably in about 3 years. I've devoted so much time to writing this one that I'm going to focus on two or three other book projects in the interim and then get back to it.
Gosh.
What are some of the other books that you've written?
I just finished a book on the War of 1812. It'll be released a little later this year. What I'm looking at is the year 1814, so we're about to celebrate the bicentennial next year, was one of the most amazing years in American history, and yet the War of 1812 is our forgotten war. Yeah. Harry Truman called it our silliest damn little war ever. and in 1814 was when the British burned the White House. Francis Scott Key wrote the Star Spangled Banner. It was the defense of Baltimore at Fort McHenry. It was when one of the largest armies ever assembled in that period in time came over fresh off winning the Napoleonic campaign, when the British beat Napoleon, and they decide they're going to invade the United States, and they march down from Canada, and at Plattsburgh and at Lake Champlain, we annihilate the British. So there's some magnificent stories from the year 1814, and in 1815 is the famous Battle of New Orleans, and with Andrew Jackson and a ragtag band of some Tennessee backwoodsmen, a few freed slaves, some Cajuns, couple of Indians take on a British army that numbers in the tens of thousands, and they wipe out the British, inflicting over 2,000 casualties, and Jackson suffers something like 15 men dead. So coming up next year, there's some marvelous bicentennial events, and I just find that no one knows anything about the War of 1812, and yet the year 1814 was one of the most pivotal years in our country's history. I would put it right there with 1865, 1933, or some of those other years. And so I put the book together to try to tell that story.
Wow. Maybe somebody will see the value of this and make a movie.
I hope so, and so we could put George Clooney as Andrew Jackson,
Oh, you already got it cast.
Yeah, I do. I do. I already have it cast.
Now, does Andrew Jackson make an appearance in your Affairs of State book?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Does Andrew Jackson make an appearance in the Affairs of State?
Oh, sure. I got a whole chapter on him. Andrew Jackson's wife, Rachel Donaldson, was married to two men at the same time, unbeknown to her. Then when the story breaks, she's called Lady Bigamist, or she's the whore of Tennessee. It's a horrible story, and she was bitterly criticized for it. And this is why Andrew Jackson fights all of his duels. He does not fight his duels because of high political principle. He fights the duels because of what men said about his wife, which was true. And Jackson kills men over it. So it was a scandal that dogged them. And during the 1828 campaign for president, it was one of the ugliest campaigns in history. People think that the commercials were bad this time around. The he said stuff in 1828 was horrible. Jackson's opponents, John Quincy Adams' supporters, used to call Jackson the wife thief. They said, if you vote for Jackson, there will be a whore as the hostess of the White House. So it was a sexually charged, scandalous election, so I try to tell that story and how Jackson never really got beyond, nor did his wife. In fact, she was hoping and praying that Jackson would lose the election because she didn't want to go to Washington and have the scandal dog her. And I always say, be careful what you write, what you hope for and pray for, because right after the election, when he wins in 1828, but right before the inauguration in 1829, she dies of a heart attack.
Oh,
in fact, she's buried on Christmas Eve in the gown that she was going to wear to his inaugural. So he goes to Washington, a widower, and never really gets over losing her. He says she did not die of a heart attack. She died of a broken heart. Because of all the tongues that wagged about her scandal.
Yeah.
Well, if you're intrigued by that, you need to pick up this book, Affairs of State. There's more information probably on your website. I believe it's robertwatson.com. Is that correct?
.us,
robertwatson.us.
Or you can contact me through Lynn University at www.lynn, that's L-Y-N-N, .edu, and I welcome emails.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Writers' Voices.
Very
my pleasure, and thank you for what you do. I think this is wonderful programming.
Oh, great. Thank you. And, Mom, do you have a final closing quote for us today?
This is George Burns said this. Too bad all the people who know how to run the country are busy driving taxicabs and cutting hair.
And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile on Friday, and have a great week if you're listening on Monday morning, and see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.